The headlines: the U.S. president says the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan marks the end of an era of major military operations to remake countries. Filipino healthcare workers protest in the capital, Manila, to demand an end to what they call government neglect amid a sharp rise in COVID-19 cases. Mexican authorities step up efforts to halt a caravan of Central American and Caribbean migrants heading for the United States on foot. Hello and welcome, everybody. The U.S. president says the withdrawal of American forces from Afghanistan marked the end of an era of major military operations to remake countries.
This decision about Afghanistan is not just about Afghanistan. It's about ending an era of major military operations to remake other countries. The world is changing. We're engaged in a serious competition with China. We're dealing with the challenges on multiple fronts with Russia. We're confronted with cyber attacks and nuclear proliferation. We have to shore up America's competitiveness to meet these new challenges in the competition for the 21st century.
In his first public remarks since the U.S. pullout from the country, Joe Biden said the war in Afghanistan should have ended long ago. Biden rejected criticism of his decision to stick with the August 31st withdrawal deadline, adding that his choice was between leaving and escalating. The U.S. president emphasized that the evacuation operation from Afghanistan was, quote, an extraordinary success. He, however, acknowledged that up to 200 Americans were unable to get out when the airlift ended Monday. Investigative journalist Tony Gosling believes the United States invaded Afghanistan under false pretext and continues to distort facts.
I'm afraid all this stuff about going over there to bomb terrorist training camps, military targets, that was what they were doing for the last 20 years is obviously complete nonsense to anybody that's in touch with what's been going on the ground in Afghanistan. Really, I don't think a very real speech. This is just designed to pull the wool over the eyes of the US public. And I would hope that at least there'll be some questions asked by the journalists about just how real he thinks the threat to the United States ever was or is into the future from Afghanistan, which is really rather happy that these United States troops and the British troops and other NATO troops have gone. But the idea that they're going to be conducting terrorist attacks, if terrorist attacks did happen now, I would suggest that they're mostly being done by the West, by the NATO intelligence services, in order to try and politically exploit this to gain more power. This is what they do with the politicians. They say, oh gosh, there's this terrible, terrible threat. We need more power. We need more money. And that's how the deep state operates in the West here.
UN Secretary General warns of a looming humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan. Addressing an emergency session of the Security Council, Antonio Guterres said half of all Afghans depend on some form of humanitarian aid. He added that hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced in the recent fighting and asked the international community to harbor Afghan refugees. He urged all parties to protect civilians and, quote, exercise utmost restraint. Guterres also expressed concern over accounts of mounting human rights violations against women and girls. Elsewhere in his remarks, the UN chief called for unity to prevent the threat of terrorism in Afghanistan. Well, for more on that story, we're now joined by peace and justice activist and scholar Savros Ruhollah Rezvi, is joining us from the city of Qom. Mr. Rezvi, welcome to the program. Walk us through the recent comments made by Antonio Guterres.
The reality is that the neighboring countries, Iran and Pakistan, are actually taking the main burden of the refugees. You should know that Afghanistan is one of the, Afghanistan has the, the biggest number of the refugees across the globe. It has, based on the, registered number of the refugees, at least minimum, something like 3 million registered refugees are in Iran and in Pakistan. These are the registered refugees, but everyone knows that the number of those real refugees on ground are much more than this. Iranians have said in recent years that they are hosting something like more than 3 million refugees. Most of them are not registered ones. They have entered illegally because of the situation inside Afghanistan. And the same is the situation with Pakistan. And the problem is that United States of America, who is the main responsible for the occupation of Afghanistan and what they did in recent weeks and their evacuation from Afghanistan in that, you know, messy condition, is not taking the main responsibility of the refugees in Afghanistan. We have been all, I mean, observing and following the news from Kabul Air Base. The concentration of whole world was towards Kabul Air Base. And you should know that not more than 80,000, 90,000 Afghans have been evacuated from Kabul Air Base. Meanwhile, if you look at the condition of the borders between Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Afghanistan, based on some of the reports, daily 7,000-8,000 Afghans are crossing these borders, either legally or illegally. And there have been also, you know, flights full of the Afghans who evacuated from Afghanistan to different cities inside Pakistan and inside Iran. And this is the main problem. United States of America is not hosting, less than 200,000 Afghans, who are not, most of them are not, you know, refugees. And the main burden of the refugees of Afghanistan is upon the shoulders of the neighboring countries. And no one is taking their responsibility over there. Let's not forget those Afghans who are now fleeing from Afghanistan. And we have hundreds of thousands of Afghans, at least like maybe 3 to 4 million Afghans who have been displaced inside Afghanistan. They are escaping from the fear. Either this fear is because of the, I mean, government, because of the rule of Taliban, or it's because of unclear future, economic future of Afghanistan. And we all should know that the main responsible, internationally responsible for this mess in Afghanistan at the first stage is United States of America. But unfortunately, they are not taking their responsibility, and international bodies such as United Nations are not telling anything about the responsibilities of the occupying forces who have now evacuated and left Afghanistan and put behind, you know, this misery and this, you know, catastrophe for the Afghan people inside Afghanistan. 80% of the Afghan refugees are either in Iran or in Pakistan, and just 20% of them are currently being taken to some European countries, and very little number of them are being taken to United States of America. And there is this big question, why no one is asking United States of America? United States of America is killing innocent Afghans at Kabul Air Base. They have, several people have been killed by direct fire of the U.S. forces after the blast that took place, which was claimed by Daesh of Khorasan. They have killed people over there. They had left behind Afghans and left them alone with Taliban and the new rule of Taliban over there. And they are taking the minimum responsibility. That is the big question that I believe that the international community should ask United States of America nowadays.
All right, thanks a lot, Sarah Zuhla Rizvi, speaking to us from Bonn. Moving on, Israeli troops have shot dead a Palestinian in the occupied West Bank overnight. The Palestinian Health Ministry has confirmed the deadly shooting without providing further details. The victim is reportedly a 39-year-old man who lived in a village near the city of Ramallah. Villagers say there were disturbances or clashes in the area at the time of the shooting. They say the slain Palestinian was returning from work when Israelis shot and killed him. Over the past few days, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been staging protests near the so-called buffer zone to voice their anger at Israel's siege of the territory. The Israeli army has responded with live ammunition and tear gas, injuring dozens of them, but the Palestinians say they're determined to continue their protests until the siege is lifted.
Hundreds of Palestinians have staged protests against the Israeli regime's inhumane blockade of the Gaza Strip, burning tires and hurling explosive devices toward the fence between Gaza and the occupied territories for several consecutive nights. The Israeli military, which deployed additional troops along the fence ahead of the night protests, used live fire, tear gas, and stun grenades against Palestinian protesters. Several Palestinians have been injured by Israeli forces east of the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Health Ministry's spokesman, Ashraf Al-Kedra, said several others were hurt from tear gas canisters fired at them. During Saturday night's protests alone, 11 Palestinians were injured by live fire and other aggressive measures used by Israeli forces.
I mean, it's because the laws are not being implemented, they're not being penalized, they're not being punished for all these violations of all these laws, So they feel like they have a green light to commit more crimes and more crimes. And this becomes a natural system for the Zionists. The Zionists now, they think that they're above the law, and no law is going to stop them from committing any crime that they want to do. And that's why you can see that whenever we hear condemnations from countries or even the nation's assemblies, there's nothing really coming out of it at the end of the day.
Gazans have been organizing protests since last week. They are demanding that the crossings be reopened to facilitate the entry of goods and humanitarian aid. In a statement on Sunday, the resistance committees in Palestine announced that the protests will continue until the Israeli regime lifts its siege.
Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip in May destroyed over 1,800 housing units and damaged nearly 17,000 others. Months after the war, no significant breakthrough has been reached to reconstruct Gaza. That's due to the tight Israeli blockade that has been in effect since 2007. The siege has crippled the Strip's economy and drastically deteriorated living conditions there.
The Palestinians say the Israeli regime's repeated attacks on the positions of the resistance in Gaza would not dissuade them from fighting for their freedom and dignity. Over the Israeli regime's tight blockade, which now includes deliberate hampering of efforts to reconstruct the Strip following its latest war on Gaza. Back in May, the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days, killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups fired around 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war, forcing Tel Aviv to call for a ceasefire.
The only way it really works with this particular regime, and this illegitimate regime, the Zionist regime, is by righteous, unified resistance, and that's exactly what we want to see in Palestine.
Amid the ongoing confrontations, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz met in Ramallah on Sunday, marking the highest level meeting held between the two sides in over a decade. The two discussed issues related to diplomacy, economics, and civil affairs, according to a statement from Gantz's office.
You know, it's quite clear that the Zionist regime does not want peace and does not want to recognize the Palestinians, because they had a chance many times. You can see that they're still stealing, you know, areas in the West Bank, and that's obviously international law breaches. We can see now, you know, Sheikh Jarrah, Sinwan, all these different areas, even in Jerusalem and different areas, they're still, evicting, stealing people's homes in a very, very barbaric way.
The Palestinian resistance groups have pledged not to allow the Israeli regime to continue its aggression against the Palestinian people or change the rules of engagement.
Filipino healthcare workers have protested in the capital, Manila, to demand an end to what they called government neglect amid a COVID surge. Protesters gathered around the Department of Health demanding risk allowances and hazard pay. They urged the health secretary to step down. The demonstrations took place after an August 31st deadline for health and budget ministries to pay the health workers expired. The Philippines was the first country outside China to report a death when coronavirus began to spread around the world in late 2019. Total infections in the Philippines are now almost 2 million, with more than 33,000 fatalities. Cases and deaths have recently surged due to the Delta variant, with hospitals being overwhelmed. Mexico has stepped up efforts to stop the progress of a caravan of migrants heading for the United States. On foot, immigration agents and security forces are trying to stop hundreds of migrants moving toward the capital, Mexico City, from southern Mexico. Some have been detained. The migrants, including children, began their journey days ago. They are mainly from Haiti, Cuba, Central America, and Colombia. They want to reach Mexico City to seek expedited asylum proceedings, with many planning to get to the U.S. The migrants are fleeing poverty and violence in their homelands. Thousands have already taken such journeys in the past several years. That has prompted Mexico to tighten rules at its borders to stop the migrant flow. Residents in southeast Louisiana are desperate to get food and water 2 days after Hurricane Ida hit the U.S. state. Louisianans stood in line to get what they need in the aftermath of the strongest ever hurricane to hit their state. The powerful storm has left massive destruction, leaving hundreds of thousands without power. There are reports that power would not be restored to some communities for 30 days. Louisiana's governor has asked those evacuating before the storm to stay away. He said the infrastructure could not handle their return. Ida made landfall in Louisiana on Sunday. So far, two people have been confirmed dead. The toll may rise as search and rescue operations continue. And the U.S. state of California has taken another step in prohibiting ghost guns. They are unlicensed weapons that are usually sold on the internet. The city of Los Angeles became the latest Californian city to move to ban possession, sale, receipt, and transportation of ghost guns. The cities of San Diego and San Francisco are also taking similar bids to staunch the flood of unlicensed guns. U.S. authorities have called California the epicenter of the crisis. They say two-thirds of the ghost guns seized in the United States last year were confiscated in California. Ghost guns are unassembled weapons mainly sold to online buyers without a serial number or background check requirement. In 2020, nearly 20,000 Americans were killed by gun violence-related crimes across the country. A new study has found that almost one-third of the world's tree species are at risk of extinction. The study was published by London-based Botanic Gardens Conservation International. It says more than 17,000 tree species, most of them in Brazilian forests, are threatened with extinction. That's twice the number of threatened mammals, and island tree species, including Caribbean magnolias, are also at risk, a high risk, that is, due to their limited numbers. Experts say the main threats to trees are farming, climate change, rising sea levels, and extreme weather. They say hundreds of trees are also on the brink of being wiped out. The decline has resulted in growing calls for urgent global action against a potential ecosystem collapse. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The founding of two North American neighboring countries, Canada and the U.S., has everything to do with genocide and erasure of indigenous presence, as well as erasure of the horrors committed by white supremacist authorities in government, police, religious institutions, and educational systems, says Siku, a Lulu writer, in an article published under the heading, Canada's Indigenous Genocide is Ongoing. Stay tuned for more. The recovery of mass and unmarked graves at former Indian residential school sites in recent weeks has released a deluge of outrage and grief across the settler colony known as Canada. Horrifying truths are being unearthed that reveal the treachery by which Canadian governments, churches, and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, originally stole and continue to steal Indigenous lands. We say recoveries because these are not new discoveries. This particular form of genocide unleashed against Indigenous children has been aggressively instituted and actively concealed by Canadian governments, churches, and RCMP since 1831, when the first residential school was established in Brantford, Ontario. Genocide here is defined both as murders of children and criminal acts of negligence and mistreatment that cause death that could have been prevented if authorities had acted on the concerns that were repeatedly brought to government. The high death rates, inhospitable conditions, and preventable causes of death were known. It was not secret, even beyond the stories from survivors and all we heard during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, TRC, states Anishinaabe filmmaker Lisa Jackson, referring to a national commission that took place in 2008 in a recent social media post. It was known by the government, known by the churches, and to some degree, known by the Canadian public. We cannot pretend this is a revelation. That would also be hiding the truth. This is a reckoning of generations of criminal wrongdoing and widespread complicity in this brutal system, unquote. None of what we say here is news. Rather, it is the culmination of urgent messages that Indigenous peoples have been shouting for years across the country and the globe in myriad ways, in perpetuity. I find myself frustrated with words at this point. Tuscarora writer Alicia Elliott tells people because they so often take the place of action in this country. These are recoveries of people's loved ones who never made it home. The truth that were always suppressed and denied. The anguish that makes sense of their lives and compounded righteous rage. It is fitting that the national holidays of Canada Day and Independence Day in the U.S. were preceded by this stark opportunity for citizens to finally see the truth of their countries. The founding of these two North American neighboring countries has everything to do with genocide and erasure of Indigenous presence, as well as erasure of the horrors committed by white supremacist authorities in government, police, religious institutions, and educational systems. James Baldwin described this willful amnesia in the context of slavery and anti-black racism as a sinister crime, rendering white citizens ignorant of both self-knowledge and the systematic violence that they personally reinforce. Genocide and erasure are the origins and continued modes of operation of these countries. Clearing the land for white settlement was enacted by police and government officials through the deliberate spread of smallpox in British Columbia, for example. Railroads built by Chinese laborers, many of whom were indentured, forged paths for white settlers through the provinces and shore up the country. Starvation tactics were used in the prairies to thin Indigenous populations, weaken resistance, force them onto reserves, and signed treaties in which the rights entitled to the land were officially extinguished. Erasure of Indigenous presence through the Indian Act and Reserve System, building cities and extractive resource projects over sacred homelands, sterilizing women and kidnapping children are just some examples of how this settler nation was built. After we shake off the emotional petrification and a spiritual shock. We recenter ourselves in understanding that not even horror writers can come up with something as sickening and culturally destructive as the realities the indigenous nations are coming to terms with now. And over recent years, since TRC reports were published, Mohawk Tuscarora poet, media producer, and artist Janet Rogers shares these notes. They say, "The truth is more disgusting than fiction, and it was all brought here from over there." Indigenous voices are urgently asserting that colonial genocide and erasure are far from over. Although the schools, or as many are more accurately calling internment camps, officially closed in 1996, we continue to exist within a genocidal society superimposed upon indigenous homelands that targets women and children at unconscionable rates. Canada's aggressive institution of Indigenous youth genocide carries on to this day in the accelerated form of the foster care system that breaks apart Indigenous families and apprehends children at higher rates than residential schools, redistributing them in mostly non-Indigenous families and away from their communities. It also carries on in the federal government's refusal to cease discriminating against and violating the human rights of children by obstructing immediate access to health care and other needed resources, despite direct rulings by the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal in 2016 and 19 non-compliance orders issued since then. The institution of genocide persists in the crushing ongoing crisis of Indigenous and especially Inuit youth suicide. If it were to happen in these overwhelming numbers in any non-Indigenous community in Canada, it would be considered an absolute emergency, states Inuk writer and performer Instuk Makri. "This is an emergency and it is falling on unwilling hearts," unquote. Genocide persists in the racist Canadian healthcare system that enables widespread negligence and malpractice at the expense of Indigenous lives. It persists in the extinguishment clauses that remain central to modern-day treaties with federal, provincial, and territorial governments. It persists in governments' failure to officially recognize Indigenous languages or ensure access to fresh drinking water or adequate housing. It persists and a rampant systematic racism within the RCMP. This national police force was established in 1873 to suppress Indigenous peoples, forcibly settle and relocate people to reserves and other remote locations, enforce the Indian Act, and of course, kidnap Indigenous children. Genocide persists in the arrest and criminalization of Indigenous land protectors enacting responsibilities to sources of life in the homelands. The historic erasure and fierce protection of institutionalized white crimes against humanity is finally coming to light. The callous failure to notify thousands of Indigenous families of these deaths, mass destruction of records, continual withholding of records, refusal to disclose names of perpetrators, the obstruction of any accountability or justice. Colonizers buried the truth of their horrific crimes with the bodies of the precious children in this land in mass grave sites that were never meant to be found without gravestones, without ceremony, humanity, or remorse. At least in the earth, they could be held and in some way return to creation. the deliberate effort to make these mass grave sites appear invisible, like an ordinary open field, is a perfect example of Canadian nationalism. Institutionalized racism and white supremacy have been so extensively normalized as to be invisible and even trivial to most Canadians. The ongoing violence and, yes, genocide that make way for Canadian authorities and non-Indigenous society to thrive are characteristically hidden, suppressed, denied, and simply ignored. Erasure of the truth is a practice of genocide, refusing to admit actual genocide by downplaying actions that the state not only instigated but continues to protect is a practice of genocide. These systems are in need of profound scrutiny and destabilization, as absence of remorse or accountability breeds only further promise of harm. As the Canadian government, RCMP, and churches abdicate responsibility and place the onus on each other to apologize, Indigenous voices are demanding that all of them, as well as the predators and murderers in official positions at these schools, be held to account for their crimes against humanity.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
August 31st, the end of the U.S. military presence on Afghan soil. The Taliban are celebrating what they're calling a victory and a good lesson for invaders. The two-decade-long U.S. military intervention in the country cost the lives of some 240,000 Afghans and 2,500 American troops, on top of the $2 trillion going down a drain. The U.S. and its allies already evacuated some 123,000 people from Kabul in a chaotic operation marred by explosions and deaths. Taliban are now boasting of what they are calling an independent Afghanistan that's for collaboration and interaction with the rest of the world. Let's start with a background report.
Celebratory gunfire across Kabul. Taliban fighters have marked what they called full independence of Afghanistan after the last U.S. troops left the country at dawn on Tuesday.
The withdrawal of foreign forces is a big achievement for the Afghans and their independence. It is the day of good lesson for the aggressors that they shouldn't have invaded Afghanistan.
The humiliation in Afghanistan was a legacy of four U.S. administrations. President George W. Bush invaded Afghanistan and toppled the then Taliban government after the 9/11 attacks. Washington had blamed the attacks on al-Qaeda terrorists based in Afghanistan. Bush's successor, Barack Obama, harshly criticized the invasion of Afghanistan, but his administration stuck almost with everything Bush's did. Obama maintained a major military presence in Afghanistan, frequently bombing the country with no regard for civilian lives. His administration boasted of key achievements in Afghanistan, including the training of a powerful national army. Then it was President Donald Trump's turn to stick to his election pledge on full withdrawal from Afghanistan. It took him almost his entire term in office to take the first step. It was a deal with the Taliban to pull all U.S. forces out by the end of April 2021. It came after long foot-dragging, and Trump pushed the ball in Joe Biden's court to actually act on his pledges. Biden finally took the plunge, pushing a chaotic full withdrawal in a matter of 2 weeks. It came after the Taliban ravaged the U.S.-touted Afghan army in a blitz 10-day campaign that left the group in almost full control of Afghanistan. The Afghan invasion was America's longest war. it killed an estimated 240,000 Afghans and nearly 2,500 U.S. troops. It also cost more than $2 trillion, but none of the objectives Bush had announced for the invasion were actually realized. Terror is yet to be eradicated in Afghanistan. That was also proved by the Daesh bombing that killed over 170 at Kabul airport last week. And at least a Western-style democracy was not established in Afghanistan either, which is obviously witnessed by the Taliban return to power after their government was toppled by the U.S.-led invasion of 2001. Biden only managed to put an end to the war by a hasty and humiliating exit, which some believe diminished the U.S. status as a superpower.
Now, welcome to this edition of The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. To discuss the U.S. Troop pullout, I will be joined today by member of the European Parliament from Ireland South, Mick Wallace, who is in Brussels. And co-director of the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders, in New York. Good to have you both on the show. Now, let me ask Mick, no more U.S. Boots on Afghan soil. Did Washington manage to achieve its stated goals in Afghanistan?
Well, it was very hard to say what goal they had when they went in. It was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to 9/11. There was no Afghans involved in the 9/11 attack in America. There were 16 Saudis, and they didn't bomb Saudi because they were their friends, but they claimed they were bombing Afghanistan because they were harboring bin Laden, who was involved. So they went there supposedly to get bin Laden, but they obviously didn't get him in the early days, and it took them years to get him, but they obviously said they changed their mandate and what they were supposed to be doing there on several occasions. And at one stage, it was to get rid of the Taliban as well. But I mean, the Taliban disappeared at a very early stage because they didn't actually, it wasn't in their interest to stand and fight with them. It made a lot more sense just to retreat into the mountains from their point of view. And that's what they did. But the truth be told, I mean, we can discuss it in different aspects, but America achieved.
We'll come to that, sure. Now, Sarah, what do you think?
Let me
put this question to Sarah. Sarah, what do you think was the U.S. legacy in Afghanistan?
Well, I think in terms of the U.S. goal of having a strategic base in the region from which to threaten Iran and China and the small country surrounding Russia, to have a position with hundreds of bases and forces in the region, it's an utter, complete failure, a disaster. There's no other way to put it. It achieved the goal always of the U.S. of endless profit to private military contractors, to the military and oil industries. Just billions of dollars literally disappeared into all sorts of offshore accounts. So in terms of military profit, a great, for them, a successful war, because even when they lose wars, they make lots of money. But in terms of the reputation, the standing of U.S. as a force in the region, trying to dominate the region, remember Afghanistan, also Iraq, Iran, Syria, Libya, all of these were targeted countries that the U.S. claimed that they would destroy, overcome, and dominate for the coming century the political agenda of all countries. And they've shown that they completely failed, and against a country that is the poorest, the least developed. So this is a big achievement for any force in the world seeking to resist U.S. domination. It's a big achievement and a big failure for the U.S., as I see it.
Right. Now, Mick, this sure marks the end of the U.S. Military presence in Afghanistan. But is it also the end of the U.S. interference in Afghanistan's affairs?
I wouldn't believe that for a second. And the bases haven't disappeared, and the Americans will use them again. Don't worry. the Americans have so-called they've pulled out in terms of boots on the ground around the cities and countryside of Afghanistan. But if you think that Afghanistan has seen the last of America, I don't agree. Unfortunately, it'd be good if they would have seen the last of them by now. But I'd be very surprised if the Americans just disappear off the landscape from Afghanistan's point of view. And as the other speaker said, in terms of success of the mission, you could argue that the Americans' 20 years in Afghanistan was a great success, because they managed to give over $2 trillion to the military-industrial complex, which became the main target, not at the start, but it became that very soon after that. So from that point of view, it was a great success. Mm-hmm. The American people weren't complaining. The mainstream media helped to the lie, the narrative that was coming from Afghanistan. The mainstream media, not just in America but also in Europe, bought into it. Oh, we're there for women's rights. We're there for the sake of the Afghan people. But in actual fact, they were only there to funnel over $2 trillion of U.S. taxpayers' money into the private sector. And it was a complete scam. The whole 20 years was a complete lie.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Sarah, after the 2001 invasion, the U.S. Promised that it was trying to embark on nation-building efforts in Afghanistan. Did it succeed in so-called nation-building efforts?
Well, I couldn't agree with Mick more. From the very beginning, it was a complete lie. There was absolutely no interest in democracy, nor was there any interest in the liberation of women. And that was very clear by the very reactionary and corrupt forces that the U.S. allied with from the very first day. They don't intend to leave Afghanistan now, because what they have put in place are sanctions that will deliberately create a famine, hyperinflation. They froze all of Afghanistan's money, outright theft, and froze IMF, World Bank, European Union, every conceivable penny going into Afghanistan. They proudly declared in their own publications that there's no medicine left in Afghanistan. That's how much they care for the people of Afghanistan. They declare that there is no food shipments coming in, and they made Afghanistan a completely dependent country. So Afghanistan right now will need the support of surrounding countries literally to survive this winter, because they were left penniless, and the freezing of every conceivable penny, the imposing of the sanctions on Afghanistan immediately, and then the drone attacks coming from Biden show what they're planning for the future. And those drone attacks, 7 children killed in one attack, we can see this is the future they want to have. But can they achieve it? I think we have seen the limitations of U.S. military high-tech equipment.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me put the same question to Mick. Mick, why did the U.S. nation-building mantra fail in Afghanistan?
Because they didn't even try to do it. They weren't interested in building any nation. as Sarah said, they couldn't care less about the people of Afghanistan, and they still couldn't care less about the people of Afghanistan. They reckon that there's twice as many people in poverty in Pakistan, in Afghanistan today, than there was in 2001. And God knows things weren't good in 2001. They have decimated the place. And from my perspective, what I find really nauseating is the role that the European Union and the European member states have played in supporting this American lie in Afghanistan for the 20 years. And now, after destroying the place, after creating hell for the people for 20 years, after holding them back from potential progress for those 20 years, now the Europeans are mostly worried about, are we going to get a flood of refugees trying to get into Europe? Well, given that we destroyed the place in the first place and helped to destroy the place, you'd think that we'd show some humanity, and for those that want to leave and want to come to Europe, the least we could do is actually accommodate them.
Now, Sarah, the Taliban have been trying to ease fears that the rule this time around will be different from the one in late 1990s that was marked by, you know, massive amount of violence. Now, do you believe that the Taliban's rule this time will be any different?
Well, certainly, from what the Taliban has said, they want to normalize relations within Afghanistan and with the surrounding countries. Mm-hmm. And they well know that they desperately need peace and reconciliation. They have said there will be full pardons for everyone. We have no way of knowing. We have no crystal ball. Mm-hmm. We do know that the U.S. wants to destabilize and do everything they can that they fail in this effort. And that's what the drone attacks, that's what arming the remnant little ragtag forces inside Afghanistan mean. And that is what hyperinflation and shortages, all of that means. Can they set people against each other? That has been their strategy all along. Mm-hmm. And for the Taliban, these may be very different forces than 20 years ago, because leadership has again and again been decimated, but new forces have come forward, and that is always true in history. Movements change by circumstance, and in the end, everyone in Afghanistan overwhelmingly hated U.S. domination. So they were able to come together in this resistance in a surprising and in an overwhelming way. So let's see where this goes, but not believe any of the lies that are coming out now when the U.S. wrings its hands and talks about the Taliban being a terror force. The terror force in Afghanistan, no matter how you look at it, was U.S. military occupation. That really was a spread of terror, of imprisonment, of disappearances, of enormous corruption. That was terror, and at least that has been broken for now. So let's see where it goes, but I won't believe anything coming from the media here that they're concerned for the people of Afghanistan. They're not at all.
Okay. Now, Mick, let's take a look at another aspect. What about crimes that the U.S. Committed in Afghanistan? Just recently, and Sarah referred to this, we had this drone attack by the U.S. conducted on Monday. It left 10 Afghan civilians dead, including 7 kids. So will the U.S. ever be held accountable for such crimes committed in Afghanistan?
Sadly, international law doesn't apply to the likes of the U.S. For a long time now. And that's actually a big problem for the world. And it's a big problem for the European Union as well, that the Americans have no respect for international law. And I actually see the European Union disrespecting international law too in some matters now, especially in the area of sanctions, because all sanctions are illegal unless they are sanctioned by the UN. And what America is going to do to Afghanistan now in terms of sanctions, like it's doing to 39 other countries around the world at the moment, is illegal. Killing 7 children, and I noted to date the High Representative of the European Union, Joseph Borrell, he still hasn't condemned it. But they lost the plot when Navalny was thrown in prison in Moscow. He wasn't shot. He wasn't killed. his family wasn't killed. He was put in prison for what the Russians thought was because he breached Russian law. And the European Union went into a spin over it. And seven children get illegally murdered by a US drone, and we've nothing to say about it. We have a big problem with international law at the moment. But look, if you're asking me, are the Americans going to be held to account for things like this? In the short term, absolutely not, because they remain the strongest military force in the world. They have ignored international law for many, many, many years. Really, the Americans have shown very little respect for international law since the end of the Second World War. But I tell you what, the landscape is changing. And as Sarah says, Afghanistan's main concern will be getting on with its neighbors. And getting on with Iran, Russia, China will be crucial if Afghanistan is going to actually start a recovery of any form. Now, it's going to be very difficult, very difficult, because they're starting from a very difficult place. And on top of that, they're going to have the problem of US sanctions, sadly, probably EU support for that. So it's a difficult place for Afghanistan at the moment. And they do need the support of the international community. But the chances of the Americans or the EU playing a positive role there are pretty slim.
Okay. Now, Sarah, what are the lessons that could be drawn from this U.S. troop pullout from Afghanistan after two decades?
Well, the first lesson, obviously, is don't go in and U.S. out of everywhere, because 800 U.S. bases around the world, and all of them about destruction. And the focus now on the encirclement of China, and also just creating division everywhere they can. And it is true also using sanctions, 39 countries. That's a consciously starving down of countries. And it is completely criminally illegal by every standard and measure, by every moral, political, and international standard. So this is where the U.S. wants to head, wants to continue to head, but it is also true that the decay within the United States today, there's a hurricane, when there's a flood, when there's a fire, people are on their own. We have the highest death rate from COVID right here in the United States of any country in the world. Mm-hmm. We have no functioning healthcare system. So this is also the cost of $2 trillion to Afghanistan. It means it's stolen from what are human needs around the world, and also right here in the United States. And they want to continue to do it. I think there's going to be a heavy accounting. And also, I do feel that the European collaborators are going to look twice at this and three times, wondering who they have hooked themselves to. It doesn't work in their interests, that's for sure. Right. And they were all for it while they thought they could go along for the ride and get easy pickings and be in on the take. But now they're finding out that it's cutting them out of a lot of the world and out of any kind of normalized relations. So we don't know the future with the Taliban at all or its political agenda, but we do know that there's a complete failure and collapse by the United States. Everyone can see this. Its allies can see it, its opponents, its collaborators, and it is in a weakened position. It still militarily has a terror organization, and it has enormous economic leverage to create pain by breaking sanctions, by breaking relations through sanctions. Mm-hmm. Will the people of the world begin to stand up and say, no, we're going to cooperate with each other. We're going to have normal trade and relations. We're not going to respect this illegal activity anymore. This is a big challenge, and I think it's a big moment of fundamental change.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of the Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had member of the European Parliament from Ireland South, Mick Wallace, in Brussels, and core director of the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders, in New York, with our comments and insight. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.